Well, thank you, Jim and John, for the very informative and enlightening presentations. So we'll start the question and answer session now. And I would like to invite Dr. Laurent Trottier to ask the first question of the evening.
Yeah. Okay. So actually from both speakers, we heard a lot about the importance of energy storage, dealing with the intermittence from the classic renewables. One of the things that's generally recognized is that hydroelectric power with dams and such is kind of a natural energy storage as well as an energy source. Now in Canada, we have a large amount of hydroelectricity already. We heard that we're already pretty decarbonized as far as our electricity is concerned in Canada. But there's also a tremendous amount of undeveloped hydropower in Canada. My understanding is that for whatever has been developed right now, there's about twice as much that could be potentially developed. What do you think about the idea of more fully developing this hydropower in Canada and integrating that in a kind of a North American grid that would help deal with some of these energy storage issues with the intermittent renewables?
Well, I might say that one of the, when we did this, when we were involved in this NREL study, one of the early questions that rose up was, really, shouldn't we consider Canada as well because of the intergrid connections? But unfortunately, just the way resources were, we didn't have them. So I think, the potential to kind of optimize the system by thinking about Canada in a bigger way as part of it is an important element. Hydro can be a good way to kind of operate and fill in the connections, if it's the large reservoir dams. If it's in stream hydro, then you have less flexibility in terms of turning on and turning off. You turn it off, the water goes past you, and you don't have it. But we have the very big dam projects with big storage, then those can be operated on and off. And we did consider some of that, operating some of those in the United States. The challenge with the dams we have in the United States is oftentimes they're supplying both irrigation water, and they're kind of providing in-stream water services, and so there is some limits to flexibility we could operate them. If Canada, I'm not familiar with Canada's hydro resources, whether they would be new large dams with large storage or more in-stream, but then there is a lot of controversy about building the very large hydro capacity because you flood large areas and run into issues with that. But certainly if there is capability there, that could be a valuable resource in the North American system. I have a student now working on Mexico, looking at Mexico's system, and we are there explicitly looking at how they can operate. It's an optimization problem of how they can operate and use Mexico's hydropower in a way that kind of maximizes the value of renewables. She's terming her thesis, the value of storage. And so how much would you be willing to pay for storage? Well, if you have hydro as a mix in it, then you have to pay less for storage. You'd be willing to pay less for storage, which means the system would cost you less. So I think, again, I'd turn it over to Jim. Okay. He may be more familiar with what new capacity exists in Canada.
It is exceptionally large, but it's actually happening today. So if you look at Manitoba Hydro and Minnesota Power, they're working towards a transmission line between them that'll tie in also to the building of the Kiesit on the Nelson River. And what is quite interesting about that, it is a wind hydro integration play. So Minnesota Power has wind interest in North Dakota. It has a DC transmission line from North Dakota into Minnesota, and it's going to link up with the line from Manitoba, and when the wind blows, it'll flow into Manitoba. When it doesn't blow, it comes back the other way. So that is starting now. There is significant potential in pretty well every province and at least one of the territories. It I would say it will be developed over time, whether that's 20 years, 50, or 100 years, really depends on carbon pricing. I mean, it needs an additional price to make it worthwhile. Two things. The carbon price would help with the economics there. It also requires a shift in mindset. And one of the challenges we have is a lot of the province mindset is, I have a boundary around my province, I want to be self-sufficient, and if I can make a bit of money by exporting, that's fine, but I don't want to build too much to export because you're just trying to take something from me. It's a pretty bizarre mindset because it's based on it's mine, not yours, and not understanding that it's an economic opportunity, there's a return on the investment that leads to a better environmental solution from a North American or global perspective, because you are going to get lower the carbon intensity of the North American economy by doing it. But they have a struggle thinking in those terms. They only think of, well, gee, what if prices go up or down and I'm at risk. Large hydro development always has a significant government role behind it, which means that the investor risk is with the taxpayers. So people get upset, become very controversial with these. Manitoba's going through it right now. However, if you look at North American hydropower development, there isn't a project that's been done that wasn't controversial when it was done. Massive billions of dollars in today's dollars of investment. If you look at those decisions all look brilliant. There's not one of them looks questionable or bad. They all are brilliant. If you live in Brandon, Manitoba, you have a hard time seeing that bigger picture in that perspective, and you're worried, well, will my rates go up faster if we build it or if we don't build it? Our limitation is a little bit in our thinking. With carbon price, the economics become pretty obvious.
Thank you. Okay, we'll take questions from the audience now. And if you'd like to ask a question, please come up to one of the two microphones in the aisles and just keep your question succinct. Stephen, go ahead.
Good evening. My name is Stephen Lightfoot. I do a lot of things, but I'll just describe myself as a mechanical engineer for the moment. I worked for SNC-Lavalin in thermal power for 6 years, so Mr. Burpee, I have some appreciation of what you were talking about. My question, to keep it succinct, is you described the presentations, by the way, were both absolutely excellent, and the one thing that I take away is the absolute complexity of the situation. I mean, really complex. And, I've been in this business 25 years. You've been in it longer. We can talk about these things. We could argue some of the finer points, but I'll just use the name Naomi Klein. Do you know who that is? Naomi Klein is a writer. She's kind of a leftist, but she's very influential and becoming more so in this area. And, there's kind of the left part of the political spectrum wants to have easy solutions to what, as you described, is an unbelievably complex problem. So how do you anticipate that we can communicate some of these ideas to make the better decisions? I mean, maybe it's the carbon price, but how do we, voters ultimately make the decisions. So how do we communicate these unbelievably complex subjects that require clear thinking and long-term planning to get the best decisions made? That's my question.
Yeah, short answer. A lot of work. A lot of things are happening. One of the reasons we actually wrote Vision 2050 was to help have, so we could start fostering a dialogue. One of the issues I would have with Naomi Klein has just written is, and a lot of people do this on either side of the argument, is they'll take factoids and little snippets of information and try and build a logic stream through them where there isn't one. And they provide information with inappropriate context, and what they're saying is, for the most part, is just not supportable. So how do you get back to a less emotional debate where we actually talk about what are the things we need? Well, I mean, a lot of talk that you get here in different parts of Canada and through with the Premier's Canadian Energy Strategy was on energy literacy. And I think some people thought, well, if everyone has literacy, then the decisions become obvious. And that's actually not the answer. We need a level of literacy so we can have the conversations and with politicians and politics and start making decisions that are informed. So if you look at work the pollution probe's doing out of Toronto on the energy exchange, there is work going into literacy. And having a broader public debate with all the facts on the table, and then comes down to establishing some values. And what I said earlier is the trade-off, when I said decisions are made around reliability, affordability, and sustainability, it's not an equation. There's a value component. How fast do you want your sustainable? How much are you willing to have that impact reliability? Ontario made a bunch of decisions. They're willing to let... you know, impact affordability. They were not willing to impact reliability. So if you looked at when the date slipped from 2007 to 2009, 2014, that was all in the realization the lights have to stay on. We need an integrated system and move on. So our focus and a lot of work we do is actually at the political level and the people. When we do, we have a program called Value for Money. They're targeted to what we call informed Canadians. Informed Canadians are people that get involved in debate now. They write letters to the editor. They go to public meetings and things like that. So it's just a matter of going back and back and just saying, not that their position is ever wrong. It's just let's understand all the facts on the table and the issues we're dealing with and have a real discussion on what's required. The challenge for a lot of Canadians, well, Americans are the same. I mean, if you're worried about where or you're living paycheck to paycheck, I mean, the fact is if you are doing economic modeling, discount factor is an important aspect. For an individual person, the discount factor tends to be very high. It's the dollar out of my wallet today is more important than a dollar a year or 10 or 20. But all we can do is continue to have the discussion. And knowing that everything that gets done is done within a legislative and regulatory framework, it all comes back to the politicians and politics.
I guess, just a short add-on. I think, you know, I think it is important to, fortunately, not all of us have to understand exactly how to operate a power system. you know, and I think, you know, and fortunately we don't have to understand exactly how our car works, right? But I think the issue is, you know, the issue of trust. If you have your car breaks down, take it to a mechanic and you want to fix them, do you trust what they're doing or not? So I think there is an issue of understanding that the system is complex. Is, I think, useful for people it's not the simplest thing to do, so there is some complexity, that costs might be more, something we have to kind of expect with it. I think those sorts of things have to be communicated, but then I think it is important to kind of build this trust about the system, and I think institutes like the two here, Polytech and McGill, Tissot and IET, as well as the program I run at MIT, our efforts to kind of really do objective, careful analysis and keep communication going with the public so that there is a sense. It's not that you know you necessarily mistrust your power company, but I think having carefully from a university sort of thing, it's a ability to seem more objective about things. I think that is an important part of the system, and these programs have to be dialed into reality, right? We can't be oversimplifying the problem. But I think that sort of thing can help build, you know, trust and understanding of the system at some level to allow people to kind of realize what has to happen. So I guess that's...
I mean, trust is probably the most critical issue, because when we talk to a lot of Canadians and can take them through why we need to modernize the electricity system to ensure reliability for future generations, or whether it's tying in new renewables, whatever it is, they all say, okay, I understand and I can accept the need, but I'm not sure I trust government or the utilities to make the right decisions with those investments. And so that trust really is a key one in trying to reestablish it. And you can understand why trust has been lost in so many places. So.
Great. We'll take a question here.
Yes. Hello. So I'm really interested in the economic mechanisms of this energy transition. So I guess the objective of the government is to make a quick energy transition to clean energy sources. And as it was said, what the consumers feels is important is the cost. So let's take the energy efficiency programs for cars, where there is a huge waste. If we make cars more efficient, demand of fossil fuel would diminish. So by offer and demand, the prices of petroleum will decrease. So instead of increasing the incentives to switch to a clean energy. What this mechanism allows is to prolong the lifespan of fossil fuels. So my question, I guess, is, are incremental technology improvements useless? Or do they really, are they really useful for the energy transition? Thanks.
So I mean, you know, what you point out is something that in economics is known as, I think, the Jevons paradox, which goes back to the 1800s, whereby if you improve the efficiency of something, might you actually increase the use of the resource because it becomes so much more productive to use? And that is a big concern, I think, with technology-based strategies of improving vehicle efficiency in vehicles. All of a sudden, it's cheaper to drive farther, and so we call that a rebound effect. So I think that's why we were involved in this NREL study to just look at renewables, largely with the purpose of saying what sort of problems crop up if we try to do that. But I'm completely on Jim's side of saying the right way to do this is a carbon price throughout the economy, and then technological improvement might be part of that, but it also then provides the right incentives to drive less or use a different technology. So I think when in the usual work I do with our global modeling system, we are looking at oftentimes these sector-by-sector technologies, and they're just inefficient and often ineffective because you get leakage out of the system, you get rebound effects, you get this oil price effect. You say so. So I think an efficient policy is one that kind of prices carbon throughout the economy, and if you do anything else, you almost end up having it be quite a lot more costly and less effective. So I think that's the story I've learned from the work we do.
Well, the other one, all the modeling shows the carbon price will increase over time, and that's what how you keep you solidify the savings in demand, reductions in demand. That price has to keep going up. If you just level it in there, you can get the rebound effects. So it's nothing is static; everything is dynamic, and it's also will we ever have a perfect carbon pricing? Probably not. The elements, and there's still a role of standards, and that's where standards, whether it's car standards, that I call that it's an involuntary, voluntary efficiency standard. You don't know you're signing up for an efficiency program, but there it is because it's built in. It could be standards on appliances, standards on lighting. I mean, there's a typical one of banning the incandescent light bulbs and moving to CFLs, and then we'll move to LEDs. Sometimes that's done through standards work, and that's still going to play a role.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead with the next question, please.
Hi. I wanted to ask you guys about your thoughts on nuclear, and because I noticed that it seems pretty constant in terms of your projections to 2050. Is it not being considered really because of probably a mixture of maybe ostensible economic problems, public image, political, all that kind of stuff? So is it sort of just taken off the table altogether? And you also mentioned fusion may be available within a order of decades, perhaps. Have you also looked at fast neutron reactors, stuff that's maybe more commercially readily available? And maybe include those into projections for technology pathways?
Okay, well, nuclear is, when we published this, Canadian Nuclear Association was a little upset with us because we said if you actually look at the current life of the Canadian fleet, without a plan to replace it, there won't be one, just a little after 2050. Even after all the Bruce and Darlington units are refurbished, probably take out to 2050 or thereabouts, a little some before, some after. It plays a very critical role today. It plays a critical role in the system, critical role from a carbon perspective. All we're saying is that without someone making that decision to invest anew, it won't be there. But that's the type, it's an option that is there along with all the other technologies. Part of it will depend on, there's still the ongoing debate on used fuel disposal. If you're in the nuclear industry, we've solved it. If you're
live in. If you realize that no one's agreed to do anything with it yet, we haven't quite solved it from a public permission perspective yet. And then the question is the cost, how does that compare to other ones, and can you replicate its reliability services with other technologies? That's all going to evolve over the next 20 years, a lot of impact. Fusion 2050 could be there. I don't know. It's a big unknown because right now there's still a proof of concept. I mean, it's what General Fusion is doing, if I understand it correctly, there is they have, can't describe there, but they have a way of creating plasma, a way of starting the fusion reaction, and what they're doing for about the size would be for a 100 megawatt plant, they're building physical full-size components to prove they can duplicate the physics that they know they need for sustained fusion reaction. And I think now they'll get up to, if they can get one reaction every, I can't remember, they're probably on their website, whether it's an hour or 2 hours, eventually you need one per second. So they're at that stage of evolving and whether it works. So they know from a theoretical perspective it works. Can you actually create that in the physical world is what they're working on now. I just hold that out. And there are other forms of high-density, low-density plasmas that people are working that could be there, whether it's 2050 or 2100, I don't know. So it's hard. I still have a hard time imagining, even in 2050, without on the fission side, it's a different nuclear fleet. But I would not say it definitely has to be, because I know it does not have to be. It's just when you combine, go back, sustainability, reliability, affordability, it'll have a role, I believe.
So the study I was talking about was one that looked specifically at creating incentives for renewables, so nuclear was not created incentive for. There are a couple of new nuclear power plants being built in the United States at this point. It will become operational by 2017, I think. I had a student working over the summer who did an internship in and he came back at the end of the summer, and he had done a nice job of looking across nuclear across the world. And, you know, we tend from the United States, Canada, Europe, Japan, to think of nuclear as really not having done anything. But there's been a massive growth of nuclear elsewhere in the world, and it's growing fairly rapidly in China, in Russia, and other parts of the world. You know, we worried about nuclear proliferation and kind of advancing that technology at one point. But whatever we think doesn't matter anymore because, you know, other countries have the capacity to build this whether we want them to or not. And so China can build nuclear for reported only 10% more over above the cost of coal. So that looks very promising. And some of those places, again, I think we wonder what the, you know, I've talked to people there. They say that they think they're meeting safety standards. I guess the question is just, we've had a number of countries, Russia, the United States, Japan, all kind of fail in that ultimate safety sort of thing. But it is a big technology in other parts of the world and growing now. So I'm skeptical that fusion is going to be here for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, people are containing it for like seconds and getting almost more energy out than they're putting in.
Yeah.
So you have to, it's a big challenge.
There was just a deal announced the other day, or almost a deal between South Africa and Russia for 9,600 megawatts of new nuclear to be built between now and 2030, I think it is. So, I mean, lots of part of the world, I mean, it's that or coal. They just, their economy's growing at a rate they need to have it. So we haven't talked specifically about China, but if you actually look, you know, because you can look at, China's interesting. If you look at the investment that's going into hydro, wind, and solar for a variety of reasons, but, you know, there's another aspect to, it's not specifically for a climate perspective, it's also an energy security perspective. You know, you don't want to be too dependent on all your energy resources coming from outside the country. So that's the advantage. A plus on the side of a lot of the renewables is from an energy security perspective, which is just another part of the equation.
Next question here.
Hi. I first of all want to say I really enjoyed the presentation. There were quite a few interesting figures and facts and big challenges that we need to overcome within the next few years, and it really resonated with me, so thanks. First question I wanted to ask is, so it's kind of specific. I'd like to know What do you think the role of computers in this change and then maintaining the changes that we want to make will be? And the second question is, what do you think students and undergrads in, let's say, engineering should do to become part of this critical decision-making process that you mentioned and become leaders in this field within, like, the next 3 or 4 years?
The computer aspect is actually critical. We didn't put it in those terms, but this is all about the ability to manage a very an increasingly complex system. That's all done. When we talked about evolving into the smart grid, it's the instrumentation that's put in, that we know what's happening there, connection to home energy management systems, but how it's all managed, controlled, it's all that data coming in and has to be processed and then managed where grids can effectively open and close switches and it is one of the most critical things. So it is, and in fact, I would say it's on the computer and the IT technology that is enabling a lot of these other things to happen that wouldn't have been possible, say, 20 years ago. Now, there's a risk in this, and we haven't talked about some of the other downsides, and when we get quite involved in the cybersecurity, so whatever you put in has to be exceptionally well protected because once you're dependent on that system, there are people who might want to do bad things by taking control of it. So if you manage, you can get a home energy management system from a lot of cable companies now, and imagine if someone hacked into that system and started cycling all the air conditioners or all the furnaces, what that could do to the demand system. In terms of getting into the industry, there are a host of companies within Canada now in what I would say the innovation phase or a part sector that are looking at technologies, whether it's renewable, blah, 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 the control technologies. If you want to make a difference, it's really getting in on the innovation end, I would say, as well as, though, don't discount that all the utilities have a aging and retiring population that need really good people to come in and manage the system that are broad thinkers and future-oriented.
Yeah, I was talking to someone from, I'm thinking that was Google, and Google saw the power sector as a real opportunity for what they could sell. They were hiring they'd hired someone out of the utilities to kind of think about this. I think there's, you know, because they see the utility as being really backwards on all this, and there's a real opportunity. I think there's probably a whole bunch of learning that needs to take place from both sides. I think Google probably is oversimplifying the problem, and so I think knowing both of those things and being really expert in both things would probably stand you fairly well, because I think a lot of growth of understanding needs to occur.
Well, Google's interesting because they bought the Nest thermostats, which is a lead-in or entry point into home energy management systems that could tie to it very much and how they're managed. So I would say, yeah. What we need is, if you look at the reliability of Google and the responsiveness of Google from a customer perspective, it's not good enough to meet electricity requirements. But they actually understand what you need from electricity because they manage it very closely on their data centers.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll take two last questions, and if anybody else has questions after that, the speakers will be around for a little bit longer. So please go ahead.
I come to this meeting with 40 years' experience as a civil structural engineer, starting designing an intertie between Labrador and Newfoundland back in the 70s, but looking at what would be required to build those transmission towers in the iciest, most wilderness country where the data about climate is the poorest and the variability is the largest. We get ice storms off the Atlantic there that you won't believe. I continue my career building little structures across Canada, watching how the hydrologic cycles, and just the timing of weather events has become far more less reliable everywhere I've worked in Canada. So my question to you, when you were building your models looking 35 years ahead, did you take into account the reliability of the aging but nuts and bolts, towers, cables, substations linking all of our loads to our power sources? Because I listened to Vermont, where they are on the path of a major lump of power from Quebec heading to the big load centers in New England, and they have had in the last year problems mixing in their renewable energy because their long-distance transmission service gets unstable if they try to lump too much renewable into it while they're still giving the reliability needed for these major power suppliers and sources, which have to cross this lightly populated area. I'm trying to keep this simple. If you're going to be using Canadian resources, we're going to necessarily have long, long transmission corridors. Did you look at the effects of the unreliability of our knowledge about the climate in the reliability studies you need to respect to make the system work properly?
We actually do, and we're doing a study with Natural Resources Canada right now looking at the from a climate adaptation perspective in terms of the grid and additional investment that would be required to manage that, and what are the right standards for the future, mainly dealing with severe weather, with anywhere from icing to tornadoes to hurricanes and wind loadings. That's underway. At the same time, though, a lot of the long-distance line, we're moving to DC and reducing DC cabling, high-voltage DC cabling is improving. Structures are getting a little smaller, and in some places we're putting the lines in the water so to get around that. So if you look at the Champlain-Hudson Power Express proposed from into New York City from Quebec, basically the Quebec border, most of it's underwater, Lake Champlain and then the Hudson, which actually gets away from the NIMBY issue as well. But that has to be balanced against. So if you look at from a grid resilience, you balance, there's an increased risk of long-distance transmission, there's an opportunity, but then you also have to plan the system around if it fails and what is the expected amount of failure given the change of climate. Can you protect the critical parts for emergency services until you can restore the grid? So you might have lose the grid from time to time, but your core services can be protected. And the discussion of microgrids, with some people, I think there was something released, one of Canadian groups that said, microgrids and we won't need the transmission anymore. Higher penetration renewables actually needs more transmission. Microgrids is being looked in the concept. If you lose the grid because of one of these events, can they provide core services with backup generation, which tends to be diesel? I noticed with there's a publication out of Europe yesterday and given their direction to support the renewable goals, they're talking about an investment of 150 billion euros of transmission in the EU between now and 2030. 50 billion of that is for subsea cable. So we're going to have more and more. We're going to have to deal with the impact that as you have more severe weather, you're going to lose parts of the grid from time to time, and so we have to design around the resiliency and the backup power.
I think in the U.S., utilities are, looking at this issue of just maintaining the power lines much better. A lot of that is just trimming trees and other sorts of issues, which people objected to having their trees trimmed, but then object more when they're having a power cut. So I think that's somewhat. I think it's feasible to kind of do that with some investment as long as you recognize it. So we're looking at some of that. I think the other thing that we're looking at is that actually, in the U.S. at least, a lot of thermal power plants may be vulnerable to high water temperatures as climate changes and would have to shut down because they can't meet water requirements or do something else. So the vulnerability of the system to climate is one of the issues that we're thinking about and lots of power companies are thinking about. Though the issue then of one of the issues, and we didn't really do this in the study we were talking about, but the more you interconnect the grid, the more of it fails, right? And so, it's one thing to have an outage in the Northeast, it's another thing to have an outage across the entire country. So I think that's a concern there. So I think that reliability and concern about how you can have an interconnected grid but keep it separate at some level, I think, is a critical element.
Let's go ahead.
Steve Gabriel, I'm a professor at University of Maryland in the States and also visiting professor at the Institut de l'Energie Trottier. So I have a question. We did a study recently with the Research Council of Norway. We looked at similar issues in terms of adequate energy infrastructure in different parts of the world. And what came up a lot, and I think we dismissed nuclear more than you did because it was right around Fukushima, but CCS, so carbon capture and storage, and biomass came up a lot. So my question basically is, I imagine you've done this, but just to talk about it, for the various studies, the sensitivity of the answer in a qualitative sense, you know, how robust is your answer in terms of, you know, nuclear always comes up roughly about a quarter, or, you know, no CCS ever comes up, those sort of robustness, qualitative answers.
Well, so the study I talked about was one we did with NREL and very specific sort of thing. In the other work we've done with the modeling system we have, I mean, which technology wins is very sensitive. The costs of, if you look at nuclear, carbon capture and storage, renewables, the costs are all, you know, of a similar order of magnitude in terms of what we know. So, you know, you can get, and I think there's a question of, you know, when we see this renewable study, there we get a huge diversity of things because you're kind of balancing things on a different, you have to balance all these times and loads and other sorts of things, and they each have a little unique kind of niche to play. If we go outside the renewables, then we tend to see, you know, we don't know which one, but if we have a, the cost of nuclear is a little bit lower, it's a big winner. If the cost of carbon capture and storage is a little lower, then it's a big winner. So we tend to see kind of the system being dominated by one or another technology, depending on which one is cheaper. The point is we don't know which one at this point. The renewables are a little bit unique because I think they're all kind of unique. And I don't know, if you look at electricity development in the United States, you will see, I think, we have a mix of electricity generation, but, you know, for a couple of decades it was all coal, and for a couple of decades it was all nuclear. So we have a mix because at any one time we were developing one whole thing, but then conditions kind of change. So we don't see very robust to kind of conclusion given our uncertainty about the cost of the different things.
Interesting. I mean, you're comparing different technologies, but you have to also look at what do we know about them. Nuclear is actually a much better known technology than CCS. We've been operating nuclear plants for a long time. We're now generation three more passive safety systems, and while some construction costs seem to get out of control, that's usually because we're out of the practice of building them and the quality, managing the quality control issues around it. CCS is not a known. I mean, we built the plant in Boundary Dam. There's a plant in Mississippi that's under construction. But until we operate and know them, do we actually understand them a bit better? And then we still haven't really dealt with the issue of CCS and the CO2 going into saline aquifers as opposed to enhanced oil recovery. So we can talk about costs, we can talk about impacts, but it's a guess. It might be a very educated guess, but it's a guess. So now you're looking at solar technology, say, what's the ramp down to cost? Where can that go? Well, we can project, and maybe we know how we can get there or not, but there's probably a little more certainty on that. Wind is getting bigger, as a bigger unit, so you know the cost. So, but then you get it, so, and then you could throw fusion, and fusion's just a complete unknown.
Yeah, I mean, the carbon capture and storage with biomass is kind of the big darling in some of the things, because you grow the biomass and it takes up carbon and then you burn the stuff and you sequester it, so you can get a negative carbon sort of thing. I think a lot of the studies that do that are really optimistic about what that's going to do, because the biomass is going to be more expensive than we think it is. It's not as cheap as coal, and then the carbon capture and storage has been kind of a disappointment, I think. Well, I think we were foolish, and, you know, 10 years ago people were talking about maybe 30% more than pulverized coal, but it takes a 28% efficiency hit just to do it. So already that's going to, you have to spend 30% more just to make it, and then it's a complex technology. So if you really want to go to these low carbon scenarios that people are talking about and do it very quickly, then you have to have things that suck carbon out of the air and are negative, and then it comes in. I just think that the cost is a real challenge there, and technically demonstrating it at scale.
Yeah, our ability to presume that we can plan a whole system on technologies we don't fully understand, we tend to do it time and time again.
Great.
Well, thank you. I think it's been an excellent discussion. Lots of complexities in technologies and economics, implementation issues to consider, but a very important question nonetheless to wrestle with. So with that, please join me in thanking our speakers. And just two final comments. Firstly, I'd like to thank everyone that's been involved in organizing this event, both from Polytechnique and from McGill. So lots of people put in their time and effort. Thank you very much. And please join us tomorrow evening at 5:30 for a talk by Jessica Tratnik from MIT. And so that's, as I said in the beginning, a continuation of this two-day event. So we look forward to seeing you at the Bell Amphitheater at Polytechnique. So, merci beaucoup. Bonsoir.